F. Awesome has experienced the kind of devastation few of us ever will. He was suspended from the U.S. Olympic boxing team months before the London Games, but he did not give up. In fact, he went on to create a new name and life and earn more championships than any other boxer in America. And he doesn't even like boxing.
Have you ever felt like giving up, quitting, throwing in the towel? Welcome to Never Ever Give Up Hope featuring Carol Graham. She's an author, health coach, and motivational speaker. Backed into a corner multiple times in her life, Carol shares with you stories on how she overcame some of the toughest obstacles a person can go through in life, but refused to give up hope. Rather than admit defeat, an opportunity was presented, and it involves each and every one of you. Carol will feature spectacular guests who will share their messages of hope, encouragement, and their inspiration to prove why life's adversities only make you stronger. And now, welcoming the host of the show, here's Carol Graham.
As a kid, Cam Awesome was bullied and found his strength in boxing. Today, Cam is known as the Motivational Comic, a former Olympic heavyweight, multi-time national champion boxer with over 400 wins under his belt. He rose to fame after being featured in the Netflix documentary Counter Punch, which chronicled his Olympic journey. I am so honored to have Cam Awesome with us today to share his triumph over adversity. Welcome, Cam.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited for our conversation today.
Well, my very first question is, how often do you get comments about your name being awesome?
Not enough. And people, I need you to know all puns should be intended.
I love it. Was that part of the bullying when you were a kid?
No, I didn't. I changed my name in 2013.
Okay. All right. Okay.
You know, for $200, you can be anyone you want.
Okay. All right. So let's start with your beginnings and, you know, some of your backstory when you were a kid, et cetera. And then what made you escape to boxing?
Okay. So I've been just, and I'll share that, but recently I've been going to therapy and figuring out a lot about myself and my upbringing and reflecting on who I was when I was growing up. And I've learned a lot of things from that, especially of my past. So growing up, I grew up in Long Island, New York. My mom is from England. My dad's from Trinidad. And my grandma's from Jamaica. So I ended up, my parents split up when I was four, and I ended up moving with my mom and my grandma. And I was a grandma's boy, but there's a bully that lived down the block from me. And he was a year older than me. And anytime he saw me, it was a fight. And I wasn't much of a fighter, whether he saw me playing outside, whether in the playground, whether at school. And anytime he saw me, it was pretty much on site. And I would tell my parents, I would tell people in my house, my family, and instead of, you know, mitigating or coming in and doing something about it, they told me to be tough, be strong. Like, men are supposed to be strong, learn how to fight. Mm-hmm. Like, if you get beat up, like, go back out and fight the bully again. I'm like, that's not how it works. So I didn't really feel like I had anyone I could rely on or lean on or tell. Mm-hmm. My family members would say something like, do the dishes before we call that boy to come over here and beat you behind again.
Huh.
So I don't feel like I had that support, and that bully ended up moving by the time I got to middle school. But I still had this fear, and I didn't understand what anxiety was back then. But mm-hmm. I didn't think everyone was like him, but I thought the world was full of people who would just want to fight you anytime they saw you. And it developed an anxiety in me, and I didn't know what anxiety was, but I would volunteer in the nurse's office during lunch, not because I cared to be helpful, it was, I was afraid to, in my mind, I was afraid to be in the lunchroom with all those people. And I didn't know what anxiety was. So I just thought I was afraid to be around large groups of people. And I was very insecure about my weight. And, you know, going into locker rooms now in gyms in middle school and high school, yeah. I was super insecure. And I decided I wanted to play a sport to lose weight. And because that's how you lose weight. And I couldn't make a team. I'm not very athletic. I never played any sports. So when I was 16, I realized there's a boxing gym in my neighborhood and it's a free gym. And that's a good price that I could afford. So I decided I was going to go to the boxing gym to lose. I wanted to lose weight and I wanted to lose weight and look like a fighter. I didn't actually want to learn how to fight. I just wanted to do the workout so I could look like one. Because no one fights someone that looks like a fighter.
Exactly. Good point.
So before I went to the gym, I found out how calories work. You burn about 2,000 calories a day. You consume about 2,000 calories a day. You break even. So I understood to lose weight, I had to burn more calories than I consume. And to me, before I went to the boxing gym, I was insecure. So I wanted to lose weight before I went to the gym. So I decided to go rollerblading every morning before school to lose weight before I went to the gym. Kind of like, you know, when you clean your house before the house cleaner comes over. Like, I was so insecure to go to the boxing gym. And I finally made it to the boxing gym and I had no interest in fighting. So they just let me do my own workout. No one paid attention to me. So I watched what other boxers were doing and decided to, you know, if the way they stood when they threw punches, I would stand when I throw punches. I would watch them and emulate them. And I eventually got in better shape than all the other boxers because I just wanted to work out to lose weight. So I was working out harder than anyone. I had incentive. Mm-hmm. And eventually they were like, hey, you've lost more. You're in better shape than all the other boxers. Do you want to spar? You want to get in the ring? And I was like, oh, no, thanks. My mom won't let me. And everyone in the gym started laughing. I was like, I'm joking. So the next day I had to spar and I was so afraid to spar. I was so afraid to get hit that all I was focused on was defense. And I was so sweaty and out of breath and tired after those few rounds of sparring that I realized this was the best workout ever.
Right. Good point.
So I got addicted to sparring in the gym and I felt like, and I didn't realize this, but I just wanted to be, I wanted to belong somewhere. And being that I was a heavier person, that I wasn't strong and I didn't hurt anyone, everyone wanted to get in the ring with me because you can hit me hard if you can hit me, but everyone had difficulty hitting me. So I would just spar against everyone in the gym all day and I got really good at defense. And one day the coach was like, hey, do you want to fight? And I never considered it. I didn't see myself as a fighter. I just somebody who figured out how not to get hit. And I decided to have my first fight and I won my first fight. It was the first time I ever competed in anything. I was 16 years old and I was afraid to tell my family members that I had my first fight because in my mind, I was so afraid to tell someone that someone like me aspired to be a boxer. So I kept that a secret. I didn't tell anyone I had until my fifth fight. I kept boxing a secret from my family.
And this was all in the school?
Yeah, no, this was a after school program outside of the school.
Okay.
While I was in high school. And this was 11th grade. My senior year in high school, my parents moved to Florida. And this is where I figured something out about myself. I got to Florida and I realized no one knew who I was. I was in a completely new school. I could have an English accent and no one would tell the difference. No one would know the better. So I decided I wanted to no longer be that insecure person I was in New York. So I thought about maybe four or five people that I really thought was cool. And I did what I thought they would do. I embodied them when I got to my new school in Florida. And I was a super cocky dude. And I made myself feel like I was really cool. And people believed it.
Because you did, right?
Yeah. So I was the man. It was like a movie. I was the man in high school, I felt like. And then a month before it was time to graduate, I got to go to New York to my old school to graduate and to walk with my old class. And I didn't really care about graduating with them, if I'm being honest. I just wanted to show up back to school to show them how cool I became.
Of course.
And I got dressed. I remember the first day I was getting back into school. I walked in, and the second I stepped foot on that school property, I reverted into the same unconfident, awkward I used to be. And I couldn't turn it on. I couldn't figure it out, and I couldn't wait to get out of there. As soon as I graduated, I went back to Florida, and I said, I'm not going back to New York. Because people in Florida thought I was cool. No one in New York thought I was cool, and I didn't like who I was in New York. So I doubled down on my confidence. I was working really hard. I became the number one boxer in the country within 2 years of participating in the sport. And I qualified for the 2008 Olympic trials and lost. So I live by the quote, if you can fail without being discouraged, success becomes inevitable. This is when that quote made sense to me. I realized at the Olympic trial, I qualified for the Olympic trials, everyone that lost quit. And I figured if everyone who lost quit and the guy who won turned pro, if everyone quits, aren't I automatically the best?
That's one way of looking at it, right?
That's the way I looked at it. And I figured everyone quit. So I came back the following year with the confidence that I should win because I'm the best one. I was the only one left. And I ended up winning my first nationals in 2008. I won nationals in 2009, 2010, 2011. And after my 2008 championship, they gave us a form to fill out, like your height, your weight, your reach, your hometown. And the last question was, what do you want out of boxing? Now, I joined the boxing gym just to lose weight and learn how to become more secure and defend myself. So most people answer this question by saying, I want $1 million. I want a heavyweight championship belt, Olympic gold medal. I put to be a good role model and have my own TV show. That was my goal. And it was because I thought this was back in 2008 when reality TV show was a big thing. And everyone got TV shows. And I thought if I went to the Olympics, I'd get my own TV show and I can be on TV because I wanted to be a performer, an actor. I didn't really know what I wanted to be, but I wanted to be a performer of some sorts. So my goal was never to become a fighter. It was just to use boxing to leverage to the next point in my life. So after I won nationals 2008, 9, 10, 11. Then 2012, I qualified for the Olympic trials and I win the Olympic trials. And my plan from high school was going perfect. I was going to win a bunch of national championships. I was the number one boxer in the country. I was leaving the country to fight to represent the U.S. And I would go to the Olympics, get a TV show, and retire. That was the plan. And funny things about plans, they don't always work out the way you think they're going to. I was doing a lot of traveling, and I left the country and forgot to tell the drug testing agency I was leaving the country. And they showed up to my home in Kansas City at the time to give me a random drug test, and I wasn't there.
Oh, my goodness.
I was out of the country fighting in a tournament. You need to get drug tested to fight in. And missed drug test is a positive drug test. I was suspended for a positive drug test, even though I tested negative that same week to fight in the tournament in Azerbaijan.
How did you deal with that?
Not well. Not well. First, I tried to pretend like I didn't care. It didn't really faze me. But then it hit me like everywhere I went, I had to explain that story to people. And as soon as you mention the term drug test, everyone looks at you like, oh, what were you doing? Was there something in your system? Were you doing drugs? Were you doping? And if, you know, ESPN released an article, if you were to read the body of the article, if you read the article, you would see there was no suspicion that I was doing anything. But the headlines read that I failed to meet drug test requirements. Everyone just assumes I tested negative, so right. I was embarrassed.
Right.
I was mad at myself. I became a completely different person. So when I moved to Florida and I pretended to be that new person, I was also walking to the gym 6 miles a day. And it would take me about 3 hours to walk, and I didn't have music. So for 3 hours a day, I would make up these stories about how I was the greatest boxer ever to live. I had all the money, all the cars, all the jewelry. None of it was true, but that's just what I believed.
Mm-hmm.
I was, Carol, when I tell you, I started boxing, this unconfident, quiet, shy person. And after 6 months of walking to the gym and pat myself on the back for 15 hours a week, Carol, I was arrogant. I was obnoxious. I was cocky. And I used that cockiness to win all my fights and believe in myself. Hmm. But in 2012, when I got kicked off the Olympic team, I was not that person anymore. I was a shell of him. I knew I messed up. I put all my eggs in that basket and I dropped that basket. And I don't have any skills, any certifications, any degrees. I don't know how to do anything but fight.
Right.
And so I was drinking a lot. I gained a lot of weight. I wasn't leaving my house. And I had to start personal training to make money, because when you're no longer an athlete, you have bills. And it was the first time in my adult life, because as a boxer, since I've been 18, I'm traveling around the world, and now 23, and it's the first time I have to deal with bills and life, and I had to no longer be special. If that sounds crazy.
Well, it was an ego shock.
Yeah. It was a big ego shock.
I have a question going back a bit regarding when you went back to your high school for graduation and what happened there, and that you were a different person than when you had left. My question is, why do you think, looking back with hindsight now, that happened so quickly? And did you ever go through that again?
Yeah, I think it happened quickly because of my internal dialogue. I thought I was a new person. And you asked if did it happen again. In 2012, when I got kicked off the Olympic team, all of my confidence was gone. And I would try to work out, and I was trying to lose the weight. And because I gained a lot of weight, and I would work out for a few days and I would fall off. I'd work out for a few days, I'd fall off. And then I caught myself verbally attacking me constantly, beating myself up. My internal dialogue was bad. And I asked myself, what's the difference between me now and me back in walking to high school?
Mm-hmm.
One of us liked me. So that's when I realized that I needed to start believing in myself again. And it hit me during 2012, because it came up mentally, why I reverted back to the unconfident person I did at graduation. And it was a quote, I can't remember who, Charles Horton. The quote is, "I'm not who I think I am. I'm not who you think I am. I am who I think you think I am."
That's good. Repeat that.
I'm not who I think I am. I'm not who you think I am. I am who I think you think I am. And that rang so true to me, because I realized when I got to Florida, I thought people thought I was cool. So I believed I was cool. But actually, I don't know what anyone thinks. You don't know what anyone thinks.
You just assume what they think. Right.
And when I got back to New York, I became who I expected them to expect. And I realize a lot of us, I'll speak on myself personally, a lot of times we don't want to, like, if we don't want to even, let's say you don't want to get bangs or something, because you don't want people to think, oh, you don't want to get that attention that comes with changing.
Hmm.
And I feel like I was afraid for them to think I changed. Which is crazy. I didn't work this hard to stay the same.
Boy, there's a lot in that. That's a huge statement.
Yeah.
It definitely is challenging, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mentioned I was cocky and arrogant before.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading the comments online after I got suspended. And a lot of them were saying things like, oh, I bet he's humble now.
That hurt. And
it did. And it was the greatest thing that could ever happen to me, though.
Of course.
Because I decided to look up what humble meant. Because they didn't say it as a compliment. So, Carol, have you ever looked up the definition of humble?
I'm sure I have, but I don't remember. Enlighten me.
If you were to look it up, I'll give you a few definitions that would come up. It's having or showing a low or modest estimate of one's own importance. Second definition is of low administrative, political, or social rank. And finally, to lower someone in dignity or respect. Carol, the reason why the word humility and humiliate sound so similar is because they have the same Latin root word for lowly. So when we think about what being humble means, I don't think it's, with all due respect to everyone's religious beliefs, but talking about the definition of the word, it's not a positive virtue, I believe. And I realized that I had been humbled. I had been made smaller. I had felt insignificant. And I didn't want to be humble anymore. I didn't see humility serving me. And a lot of times, let's say you're killing it in life, Carol. Let's say everything's going perfect for you, right? And you run into someone who things aren't going great for them. In that moment, you humble yourself down to where they are. But my question is, who are you serving by doing that? If instead of lowering yourself down to where they are, why not lift them up to where you are?
That's it.
So I took, that's why in 2013, I went out and I threw away the concept of being humility, and I legally changed my last name to Awesome as a reminder to believe in myself wholeheartedly, no matter what anyone else believes.
And one thing I wanted to add as you were talking, because I agree with you 1,010,000%, and that is a lot of people are proud of their humility.
Yeah, and I don't think they put thought into it.
Right, right.
And I know maybe your listeners are thinking, humility doesn't mean thinking less about yourself.
That's right.
Thinking about yourself less. Carol, I have a question. You're an adult. Who's supposed to think about you if not you?
Oh, I agree 100% with what you're saying. But I know that that's difficult for a lot of people, and especially, like you said, in the religious world, because if you're not humble, you know, people like to point that out to you very quickly.
Yeah, and the thing is, the only people who will point out that you're not humble are insecure people.
Yeah.
So I don't really value their opinion too much, because they want me to be where they are, and I want them to be where I am.
We're going to take a very quick 15-second break, and when we come back, I want to talk to you about, first of all, an attitude of gratitude that is important to you, and then we want to hear all about your new book. We'll be right back.
Carol Graham would like to show you the path from misery to miraculous triumph in her fast-paced memoir, Battered Hope. She relates her determination to succeed as someone who experienced one horrendous nightmare after another. Gang raped and left for dead, loss of a child, husband falsely imprisoned, and cancer. Nothing could break her tenacity or faith. No matter what you face, heartache, loss, suffering, or injustice, Carol will illustrate how she became a victor the same way you can. The secret is to never, ever give up hope. Order your copy at Amazon or batteredhope.blogspot.com.
Continuing our conversation with Cam Awesome, he has said some jewels, some real gems that I have been making notes as he's talking, and they're definitely bumper sticker moments, and I appreciate them because there's so much truth behind them. It might be a good idea even to go back and re-listen to what Cam is saying towards the end of the first part of this interview, because I think we all can relate either one way or the other on many of the things that he said. And so I really appreciate that. Very motivating and encouraging, Cam. Thank you. What I would like to ask you now is, tell us about your attitude of gratitude. You had mentioned that at one point in your website. I'd just like to hear what you have to say about that, and then tell us about your new book.
Okay, so attitude of gratitude. So I'm fascinated by how the human brain works. I've been doing a lot of reading. Of course, I'm no doctor, but if I were a doctor, my name would be Dr. Awesome, and that's the coolest doctor name ever. Unfortunately, you can't legally change your first name to doctor. I tried. But the way your brain works, your brain takes in billions of bits of information every moment. That's moment. That's a lot of information for your brain to process. So that's your unconscious mind receives all that information. Your reticular activating system. Have you ever heard of this, Carol?
No.
It's your RAS. That's what we call it for short. It's a filter in your brain that filters through the billions of bits of information and shows you what it believes is relevant to your brain, what you're looking for. So if you ever heard what you seek is what you will find?
Right.
This is that thing in your brain. And an example of it is, let's say, Carol, you went shopping for a yellow car all weekend. You didn't buy one, but after that, you started seeing yellow cars everywhere. Has something like this ever happened to you?
Oh, definitely. And especially if bad news, that's what I find. If somebody says something that's negative, it seems like that makes a greater implant on your brain than anything else. And you just keep hearing it from different places.
Yes. And that's your RAS at work. So you bring up a beautiful point. So the second you tell your brain you're looking for a yellow car, your brain starts pointing out all the yellow cars. Now, all those cars were there before, but they're never relevant to you. And the second you said, you know what, I'm looking for a yellow car. It's like yellow car down the block, yellow car on TV, yellow car in your kid's toys bin. That's how your brain works. It will look through all the information and just find what it believes is relevant to you. It's why whichever car you happen to drive happens to be one of the most popular cars on the road. It's because it's the car that your brain's always looking for. When I figured this out, I decided, well, let's see if I can hijack my RAS. So every morning before I wake up, before I look at my phone every morning when I wake up, I write a list of 10 things I'm grateful for. I have a little journal, pen and paper, I'm grateful for, and I fill in the blank. I'm grateful for my house. I'm grateful for my car. I'm grateful for my washer. I'm grateful for my dryer. Those are two different things. You could be grateful for everything. Carl, I grew up walking to the laundromat every 4 or 5 days because if you waited more than 4 or 5 days, you couldn't carry all of the clothes. So the fact that I just have to walk upstairs to do laundry, that's making it to my list. Now, I challenge everyone to do this practice. I do it for 30 days. It's called 300 Reasons. Every morning, come up with a 10 new things to be grateful for. Now, after week 2, it's going to be extremely difficult to come up with 10 new things every morning. So what I do is I look for things throughout my day to be grateful for, store it in my memory, call it delayed gratification, so I can write my list faster in the morning because, honestly, I want to look at my phone. And I have to finish my list before I look at my phone. When you spent your weekend looking for a yellow car and you started finding yellow cars everywhere, now, when you wake up in the morning and the first thing you're doing is looking for things to be grateful for, what do you think you're going to start to find in your life?
Of course.
you start to find all these reasons to be grateful for. And if 10 reasons a day sounds too much for you, I bet you can find 10 reasons why things aren't going good for you every day, because that's what you're training your brain to look for. Now, I'll show further about the attitude of gratitude and how powerful your mind is. Let's say, Carol, you say, I'm not capable, right? If you state that you're not capable, your brain will look through the billions of bits of information, ignoring all of the reasons why you are capable, and show you the bits of information to confirm your belief that you're not capable. This is why it's so important to speak positive things.
Absolutely.
My friends think I'm a little nuts because I every morning I meditate, I do my gratitude journal. And by the way, I've been doing my gratitude journal every day since July 26th of 2021. I've never repeated a single thing on this list. If I add someone's name to the list, I text them that day out of context and let them know I'm thinking about them. This makes my list intentional, so I just can't write random names on my list to make it full. And it also fosters a community because I'm reaching out to people I don't normally reach out to and just say, hey, love you, I appreciate you. And every so often I start to get messages from those people to tell me that they love me and they appreciate me randomly.
That's so funny you said that, because I was just talking to someone the other day and said that that's what I started doing when I was 3 years old. And I was just so appreciative that that was instilled in me as a young child. And it does change your life. And it puts you in a complete, no matter what adversity you come up against, your attitude is what gets us through.
So I've been doing that practice every morning, and I believe happiness is intentional. it's so crazy to me that people just think they're just going to accidentally become happy. I put so much work into my happiness, and I'm so conscious of what I consume. Food-wise, I've been vegan for 12 years, but I'm conscious of what I consume. Music-wise, there's certain music that I stopped listening to because it was derogatory to women, and it was more violent than I needed my music to be. And you start to insert these things into your life because what you seek is what you find. I want to only put positive things in my life. I don't watch the news. I don't know what's going on in the world. It's not like I can make a difference anyway. And I can't help other people until I help myself. So I'm very big on the things I consume. For example, I have a friend who she loves true crime. She listens to true crime podcasts all day at work. And when she comes home, she watches murder mysteries. So to sum up her day, she listens to people get murdered all day. She watches people get murdered in the evening, and she dreams about people getting murdered at night. Carol, you'll never believe this about my friend, but she has anxiety. Crazy, right?
No, not so crazy.
It's like what you seek is what you find.
Exactly.
I'm very big on, like, about 20,000 people follow me on Instagram. I follow maybe 100 or something people because I'm very conscious of things I follow. If you post negative things, I don't want to follow you.
Right.
If you post political things, I don't want to follow you. I'm vegan. If you post animal cruelty things to inform people, unfollowing you. I don't need to see that. I'm already vegan. I can't be more veganer. I'm very big about the things I consume because that becomes your reality.
That becomes your reality. I like that.
Yeah, you create your reality. So the person who watches murder mysteries and listens to their podcast all day and has anxiety, they are a creator of their own reality. You choose the things you consume. And a lot of times we're addicted to these things. I'm not speaking as if I'm above it. We're addicted to toxicity. We're addicted to these crime shows, to gossip. We're addicted to, a lot of us are in these group chats, some ratchet group chats where we're talking crazy things to each other and posting really inappropriate jokes. It's like those are the things we allow to seep into our life and create the reality we exist in. And if you want to change your reality, you're going to have to shuffle the deck and change some things completely in your life.
Now, is a lot of what you're sharing here in your book?
Yeah, actually a lot. So yeah, a lot of what I'm sharing is my book. I'm just passionate about it and like how your brain works and how you can create your own reality. And if you can create your own reality to live where your algorithm is positive, your algorithm of life, not even social media, you're listening to positive things. You're listening to positive podcasts. You're listening to self-help stuff. You're reading self-help books. You're a good person. I believe all the books, all the religious books teach you how to be a good person, because once you're a good person, and you treat people well, you'll start to see all the other people treating you well. And you will exist within heaven on earth. Now, if you're conniving, if you're a thief, if you're deceitful, you'll start to see those conniving, deceitful, thieving people. So if someone cuts you off in traffic, you'll think, oh, they're trying to screw me over. Screw them. Because that's the type of person you are. And then you exist on hell on earth. So I'm big on creating your own reality.
How do you respond then to people who seem to have all the right attitude and yet have so much trauma and negative things happen to them?
So you can't control the things that happen to you. And you could be a victim of the things that happen to you, but you can't be a victim when it comes to action.
Right.
You can't control what happens to you. You can control the way you react to it. And
yes.
I'm not on Zen level by any means. I still get upset, and there's still people I look to as influences for me to remain more positive. But when something bad happens to you, it's the way you interpret that thing. And the whole, my quote is, if you can fail without being discouraged, success becomes inevitable. I'm not saying you're not going to fail. You are definitely going to fail. I actually hope you do fail. If you're not failing, you're not trying. Like, something you can accomplish on the first try is not called a goal. That's called a to-do list.
I love that.
You're supposed, failing is how you get better. It's how you improve. It's how you gain experience. So the thing to focus on is discouragement. If you can fail without being discouraged, how do you stop yourself from being discouraged? Because if you're not discouraged, you'll keep on going. And if you keep going, you have experience on your side, and eventually you're going to achieve what you're looking towards. But the discouragement part is where we need to focus on. And if you're watching negative things, if you're filled with gossip and drama, you're less likely to be a positive person, more likely to be discouraged, and more likely to quit.
And don't you also attract people who think the same?
Oh, yeah. Birds of a feather. I don't believe that opposites attract thing. I believe it's definitely birds of a feather. Like, I know a lot of single people who keep saying, like, oh, everyone I date's garbage. And I'm like, yeah, of course they are, because you're garbage. And here's what I mean by that. Let's say that you have your stuff together. Everyone has their life together on their at their level. And there's people above them and below them that they're striving towards and trying to avoid. Now, if you go out with somebody who has their stuff together less than you, you're less interested in that person, unless you're a fixer, which some of us are. Because some of us are fixers. But you attract, if you're doing the work on yourself, you will attract the people who are doing work on themselves. But imagine you're doing all this work on yourself, you're reading, you're doing self-improvement, and you run into somebody who's not doing the work. You can clearly tell they're not doing any of the work. You're not going to be attracted to that person. You're not going to let that person in your inner orbit. So the more work you do on yourself, the more people you will begin to attract. You will attract, and they will attract you. But first, you got to do that work.
Again, so many things to think about. This has been excellent. Is there anything, Cam, that you would like to share in closing, whether it's motivational or inspirational or a challenge of some kind? What would you like to summarize?
I would say that gratitude practice, do it for 30 days, but also if you're a parent, do it with your children. And if you have extra young children, if your children are young, let's say they're 5 years old, have them write 5 things they're grateful for.
Excellent.
And every year for their birthday, they get to add one thing to the list, because it's so difficult. You said you're great that you adopted the mindset that you did early on. Imagine if you didn't have to teach your child to be grateful anymore, because they were already brought up that way.
I believe that 100%. Thank you so much, Cam. This is enlightening and inspiring. And we certainly are going to promote this every place we can, not only what you shared, but also on the internet, because what you shared, we can share with many others just verbally. I mean, it becomes a lifestyle. It is a lifestyle.
Yes.
And what a lifestyle to have. So much healthier in so many ways. So thank you again. And I really appreciate you being on Never Ever Give Up Hope. And I look forward to sharing your book as well, and many of the thoughts that you shared with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Never Ever Give Up Hope, featuring Carol Graham. Did you know that most people succeed because they are determined to? Quitting was never an option. Carol loves your comments and will respond to each one. So please subscribe and review this podcast. A rating of 5 stars would be outstanding and appreciated. Remember, if you are still here, there is always hope.